If you'd like to support this podcast, please check out our support us page at asymmetricalhaircuts.com.
Yes, do buy us a coffee on Patreon. That way you also get to hear our special War Criminals Book Club recordings with our fellow international justice reporter, Molly Quell.
He steadfastly insisted that he was guilty, quote, only of aiding and abetting in the commission of the crimes with which he was charged, that he himself had never committed an overt act. And like, I think I could have written that sentence basically for every single defense of a suspect I have ever covered in any trial in any court for like war crimes, genocide, crimes against humanity.
It's often a bit of a riot.
And sometimes it's a serious discussion about books, and sometimes not, and sometimes films. And we'll pick things that portray the worlds of international courts and war crimes.
And it's only on Patreon.
Come find us there.
Asymmetrical Haircuts, Justice Update, with Janet Anderson and Stephanie van den Berg.
Hi, Janet.
Hi, Steph.
So we're going to show some insight into the process for some of our listeners. How is the ICC operating and how do we as journalists try to find out what's going on? So what happened is I asked for comment on a story that I was putting together for Reuters about whether the ICC, how the Office of the Prosecutor is managing, especially with Ukraine and Palestine. And while I was asking the Office of the Prosecutor questions, they basically offered me an interview with Deputy Prosecutor Nazat Shamin Khan.
I've spoken to her also once before. I think it was sometime last year. She gave me an on-the-record interview about Israel-Palestine. I found her a very careful diplomatic kind of speaker in that sense. And I needed to really work my way through what she said to search for the nugget. So I wonder, what did you find? Did you find lots of shiny bits of gold or just a bit of light gold dust?
There was some very interesting stuff in there, I think, but let's have the audience judge. But to help us be the gold panning sieve, we are joined by one of our favorite ICC watchers, Mark Kirsten. Hi, Mark.
Hi, thanks for having me. It's wonderful to be here. Thanks, Steph, in particular for your terrific and ongoing coverage for Reuters and others that I read regularly. I'm not a religious person, but I really think you're doing God's work in explaining some of this stuff to people.
That's the compliment I needed today because I've been digging at something and not getting anything. So,
and so important. I have people sharing stories to me about the ICJ or the ICC from you and the way that you so clearly lay it out, and then it's covered in other newspapers, including local ones here. It's really incredibly important work, and then hopefully it makes people understand not only what's happening, but makes this crazy little world of international law a little bit more accessible to people. So thanks.
Well, apart from being a big fan of Steph's, Mark is also an assistant professor at the University of the Fraser Valley in Canada, and he does regular working times with the Wayamo Foundation, which I particularly think of as their work across Africa, engaging with lawyers and activists there.
So I tried to put to Mrs. Khan some of the major critiques to the ICC and the Office of the Prosecutor. Maybe for listeners, which we should try and explain what they need to know and give a little primer.
Oh, Steph, can I do a bit of Stephopedia here? Please.
If you think you can do it.
Okay, here goes. When Karim Khan came in as the new boss at the Office of the Prosecutor of the ICC a couple of years ago, he seemed to really inherit quite a demoralized office. There'd been a big review of the ICC as a whole, the independent expert review, and via that we saw quite a lot of detail about how bad an atmosphere there was there. Previously, we've had two prosecutors, Luis Moreno Ocampo from Argentina, Fatou Bensouda from the Gambia, and they'd really spent their time setting in motion a lot of different things. But if you look at it as a whole, they were basically relying on the African countries, and the Africa bloc is a big one at the ICC. They signed up en masse to the ICC, and they'd all been sending their political opponents and their rebel leaders off to the court. There have been a couple of referrals from the Security Council, but that's really dried up. Bensouda particularly opened up investigations, for example, Georgia, and then out of Bangladesh, which is also a member, the investigation into what happened to the displaced Rohingya population of Myanmar. So she was very much working at getting out of Africa. And that culminated her particular time with the very bold decisions to open up properly the Palestine investigation and to take on an Afghanistan investigation, which brought her into direct conflict with the Trump administration over in the United States, where the ICC was being admonished and even her own personal assets were being frozen. It was a pretty parlous state. And Karim Khan, I suppose, I don't know what promises he's made, but he had backing from quite a few important states. And really, everybody's been watching carefully to see whether he'd carry on with these big, tricky investigations or whether he'd rather kind of hedge his bets one way or the other. Okay, Stephanie, take over. Tell us where we are now.
Where we are now is a very significant time at the ICC. Most significant has been the Ukraine invasion in 2022. There was a huge effort by national authorities and by the international community to support criminal prosecutions and also support the ICC. So it seemed like this might be the new dawn for the ICC when everybody agreed that the ICC should do stuff in Ukraine, including the ancient foe, the US. There was a new joint investigation team together with Eurojust. There was a lot of extra money. Khan started a general trust fund to improve all the evidence gathering and processing. And the idea was that the rising tide would lift all the boats. But then in the last 6 months, we have seen Palestine and Gaza. There is huge pressure on Karim Khan and the OTP to take action. He said he will look at Hamas crimes as well as Israeli ones. But also in the background, we have Sudan. There is a civil war and huge displacement. We've seen it before. There are a couple of genocide arrest warrants for Sudan, but nothing was done. We have a former president in Sudan who has an arrest warrant of the ICC against him, but he's still kind of somewhere in Sudan. And now all hell has broken loose again. We have Libya. That's the case. So those are both your Security Council referrals. And in Libya, they want to look at the issue of African migrants and trafficking. And there is also still Myanmar. They only have jurisdiction on the crime of deportation, but the military government there is also under attack.
Oh, so, okay, a big long list there. Maybe before we get to the first of the deputy prosecutor's answers to your questions, Steph, Mark, let's turn to you. Would you say that's a bit of a, I don't know, a fair summary of the state of play, that Karim Khan has an awful lot on his plate? The world is watching intently to see when or if these investigations deliver.
Yeah, absolutely. It's pretty amazing, actually, for me to realize that we're one third through Karim Khan's tenure as ICC prosecutor. But I think if you look back at Fatou Bensouda and Luis Moreno Ocampo, the most active periods of their tenures in terms of issuing arrest warrants, or at least in terms of actually getting arrest warrants enforced, which Karim Khan has had none, right? There's not been a single arrest warrant enforced during his tenure. They're most active at the end. And I think that's because when they come in, they're doing all of these other things, kind of setting the table for what they think their tenure is supposed to look like, what's going to define them, and then they get particularly active. And I think you're right to note that there was obviously a lot of pressure for the International Criminal Court to get quote unquote out of Africa under the last part of Bensouda's tenure. But I think we should be very careful about that and very wary. I mean, you spoke about it yourself. We have this massive humanitarian crisis and a litany of international crimes committed in Sudan. We should be wary of the pendulum swinging to say, actually, we should focus on all these situations outside of Africa and the African continent, when in fact you have one that deeply deserves attention from the ICC in Sudan. And I think there's lots of people I work with and others who are frustrated about the lack of action on atrocities in Sudan and Darfur. Libya still remains a situation where mass atrocities happen. You have this very bizarre situation in Nigeria, legally speaking, in the sense that you have a preliminary examination that's completed, but no investigation that's open. When I was learning about the ICC, and I think every single textbook you read says there's a preliminary examination or there's an investigation or you close them. You close one or the other. There isn't a purgatory space between them. And yet there appears to be one. And now it's been a couple of years. The court should be told or should be asked to do something about that and finally decide one way or the other where it's going to stand. We have Burundi, Mali. These are all situations in Africa that I hope don't pay the costs of people saying, well, the court actually has to be out of Africa and do other things. So hopefully there's a rebalancing and I imagine we'll see a more active Supreme Khan in the coming years.
When I started my interview with Deputy Prosecutor Khan, I talked a bit about the difference in the situation with the state of Palestine, as the ICC calls it, or the Palestine investigation, and the Ukraine investigation, where Ukraine, you see all this money and resource being thrown at it from all kinds of states. And within a year of starting the investigation, you had an arrest warrant for Putin and a lot of people in the Palestine situation saying, this is all going super fast. Why aren't you moving that fast on Palestine? And so I put to the deputy prosecutor that there's criticism that the OTP is operating at two speeds and that it depends on politics.
Well, I don't think there are two speeds. I think that the office has delivered incredible results, actually, in response to all of the situations that we have. And we've done this in a myriad of ways, both at qualitative level, so really to ensure that we deliver better results at a more fundamental level, but also quantitatively in terms of the numbers of cases that can be brought before the courts. So let me just deal first with quantitative results. It becomes necessary when you have many complaints in relation to a particular situation, or many situations, as we do across the OTP, that you have to focus on particular areas of those investigations. If you don't, then it's a scattergun approach. You do very little on everything, and then you spend years doing it. So a far more efficient approach is to prioritize within situations, to ensure that we have sufficient human resources, including experts, and also to have timelines so that the team knows that they must deliver within a particular time.
So, Mark, do you think this is a new approach, a different approach from previously? And I'm asking you that because I'm not too really sure whether it is. I mean, it's actually making priorities within a situation.
Well, this reminds me very much of the way that many people at the ICC at senior levels will talk about the ICC. You know, we've delivered incredible results and can get better results. Like, what does that mean? If in the first third of your tenure, you have not had any arrest warrants enforced, it's very difficult for me if I'm measuring results as trials and prosecutions, etc., or new people being brought to the ICC, to say that those are incredible results. To me, I worry a lot that the ICC is always willing to see things within a lens that is quite hubristic, that sees itself as always doing great work, as opposed to being more modest and saying, actually, we're doing some really good work, but we're actually struggling in other context. And I think that's exactly what you see at the ICC, that there are some really important things being done. I think it's remarkable that arrest warrants were issued as quickly as they were for someone like Vladimir Putin and the other warrants that were issued in Georgia and Ukraine. But the results in terms of enforced arrest warrants just aren't there. And of course, you can't lay the blame at the ICC for all of that because it doesn't have a police force, etc. But that is, at the end of the day, one of the results that people will want, which is not just arrest warrants, but enforced arrest warrants that lead to fair trials and prosecutions and hopefully at least some convictions. In terms of your question, Janet, no, it's not new. The ICC issued a policy way back in 2016 around prioritization and how that would look. I think when we look at those types of policies, I think they tell us some things and don't tell us other things. So they tell us that they are going to prioritize certain crime sets or certain perpetrators over others. But I also think that there's a little bit of, you know, a Pandora's box that we don't get to look into. That in the office of the prosecutor, what exactly that prioritization looks like and the ingredients that go into deciding aren't particularly transparent. And I actually don't think they have to be particularly transparent. Look, if I as an outsider know exactly what the Office of the Prosecutor is doing, that's not a good thing, because I don't want Vladimir Putin or Benjamin Netanyahu to know exactly what the Office of the Prosecutor is doing at any given time. So I think there's a certain amount that we cannot know, but it is not new. The idea that they're not working at two speeds, frankly, in my view, makes no sense. I don't know how many investigations they have going on. 10?
I think it's 17, no?
Okay, if it's 17, then they are working at 17 different speeds, One cannot rashly make the argument that if you put Nigeria into the purgatory of being between preliminary examination and investigation, it's going at the same speed as Ukraine, which has had 4 arrest warrants issued in the span of 2 years. That's not the same speed. And I don't think the ICC has to come out and say, we do everything the same way. And so when we're comparing something like Ukraine and Palestine, I think what people are saying is, in terms of all of the variables that would demand prioritization at a certain high level of speed, what's happening in Gaza seems to deserve that as much as any other situation. Why wouldn't you move as fast in Palestine as you would, you know, say in Ukraine in 2022, 2023? And I wish they could explain that a little bit more. That being said, in my experience at least, everybody's upset with the ICC until it does something. So everybody will say it's too slow. Everybody will say that it's not doing enough. And then it'll do something remarkable, like issue an arrest warrant for a sitting head of state or a prime minister or a defense minister. And all of a sudden, that whole narrative will shift. And the ICC will then be asked questions about whether it can enforce those arrest warrants or what will happen as a result of those arrest warrants. But the narrative will shift. And I think we'll probably see that in the Palestine situation as well.
Deputy Prosecutor Khan also went on a bit to explain what it means in practice about having specific priorities. I found it also a bit like management speak, like we have a list and we have to do this and we can't move on until we've like ticked that off the list. But what exactly is on the list is unclear. But here she is explaining what exactly they do and what they try to focus on.
Once delivered, whatever result it's agreed that they will deliver, you can then move on to the next prioritized area of the investigation. So it's like taking pockets of each part of the situation based on the seriousness of the matter, the numbers of people in the civilian population who have been impacted, as well as sexual and gender-based violence and crimes against children. I mean, these are roughly how we would decide whether a particular priority area should be dealt with first before moving on to something else. But pragmatically speaking, in deciding that, we would have to ask ourselves, where are we going to get the best results faster? So quantitatively, we do need to address those issues before deciding we're going to prioritize an area. And when we do, until we have achieved what we have said we will achieve in terms of arrest warrants or an internal stocktake or an evidence review, we don't move on to the next one. So there's a lot of pressure on all of us to deliver within those deadlines, but it works.
Yeah, what I heard her saying there is that there is some kind of a scale grading sense that they have to judge seriousness, numbers of people who've been affected, and they add into the mix sexual and gender-based crimes and crimes against children. That kind of feels quite clear, but we don't actually know what that yardstick is. We don't know exactly how they're making those choices, but at least I hear that they are making choices.
Yeah, and she also really wanted to stress that in each team they have experts and that it's super important to have cultural knowledge and have people who know what's happening on the ground. And here she explains that.
More challenging is the qualitative part of the work we do, because not only must we achieve results, but we must do it at a granular level with a greater understanding of a situation to ensure we have cultural knowledge, that we have enough experts in our teams who will explain cultural knowledge, as well as the synergy between culture and gender, for instance. And for that, we need to work very hard at our policy work. Policies are really useful generally in every institution, but here we have the added challenge of ensuring that the policy is directed at the work we do.
Mark, I put to her that there was criticism that they're putting out all these policy papers instead of just issuing arrest warrants. And were they not wasting the time, but focusing a lot on theoretical things and not putting out actual cases? And she said, no, these policy papers are what is needed to come to actual cases. I wonder what you make of that.
Yeah, it's an interesting development, say, over the last 10 years. And I agree that the Khan administration has had more policy papers perhaps than before. But if we take a step back and think about that question that we were talking about in terms of prioritization, that was basically a policy paper that explained that the ICC would have to look at certain types of crimes and certain types of situations more than others. And it would basically create a hierarchy of crimes that it would examine. And if we recall, one of the policy approaches at that time that explained prioritization was to look at crimes that have been historically under-examined. And so what we've seen starting really a long time ago, this isn't a Karim Khan thing, but starting really with Ocampo, is a growing emphasis in international criminal law more generally on sexual and gender-based violence or conflict-related sexual violence, as well as children. Children is the one commonality that links all of the prosecutors, right? If we think back on some of the very first charges that Ocampo laid against someone like Dominic Ongwen, he went for a child soldier, but he also went for Thomas Dilo Lubanga for the conscription and use of child soldiers. And so children have, I think, because of their particular vulnerabilities, but also because of the different prosecutors we've seen had, there's always been an emphasis on them. So I think that's quite good. And that's quite important as an area of priority for the prosecutor's office. And so I believe the same thing for sexual and gender-based violence or conflict-related sexual violence, that there needs to be an emphasis on those crimes. Where it gets harder is to know, well, what does that look like in practice? Because we have those policy papers, but we also have a policy paper from about 8 years ago talking about environmental crime and that the ICC was going to prosecute crimes related to environmental damage, perhaps as war crimes. And we haven't seen anything from that. And of course, as you both know so well, having covered it multiple times, whether it was in a policy paper or some kind of policy related statement, there was also this question about linking human trafficking and abuses against migrants with crimes against humanity. And I know that the ICC has been kind of sharing evidence with national authorities that hopefully have been addressing some of these crimes. But, you know, we have never seen a charge of crime against humanity related to human trafficking on the Mediterranean or against, for example, Libyan authorities who abuse migrants when they're pushed back onto Libyan shores. So on the one hand, some of these policies can be very helpful. They help us understand where the ICC prosecutor may be going or what their thinking is. And I think they also help us understand not just priorities within the ICC or Hague bubble, but priorities within this wider project of international criminal law. And on the other hand, sometimes they feel a little bit like, here's a statement of what we could do, but we can't really rely on those being what you will do. Now, going back, it's hard for me to fully understand the logic behind some of what is said. So, for example, you have the deputy prosecutor having said there aren't two speeds here on the one hand. And on the other hand, we have to do all this prioritization work to get the best results faster. Well, again, I think it's okay. I think it is legitimately okay to say that different situations require different levels of speed because perhaps the prioritization of different types of criminality is different. Perhaps there's an ability to influence the conflict or reduce the level of perpetration of crimes if different speeds are used. Perhaps the evidentiary approaches are different, right? So, you know, if you have access to the territory or not, it may be different. Although the ICC has issued many arrest warrants without having access to the territory. And we can't also at the same time discount the fact that there is this thing, there's this kind of elephant in the room that I think always exists, which is there may be arrest warrants that we don't know about, right? Not all arrest warrants are issued publicly. And I am certain that there are some that haven't been published. But going back to this point is I think there's a way to make this all kind of make sense for the deputy prosecutor and what I think many people who talk to ICC staff, especially senior staff, want is more reasoned clarity on what is happening, when it's happening, and why. Don't give us the gory details because we shouldn't know. Make it make sense. Sometimes those policy papers help make it make sense. Sometimes they don't. For what it's worth, I still miss the best policy paper that I ever got, which wasn't a policy paper, but the yearly report on preliminary examinations that really shed light in a concrete, logical way about what was happening in each situation, why it was happening, gave us a bit of insight. You could read that and say, okay, you're working at different speeds. You're facing different challenges. We get that because no situation is ever going to be the same. But there was a level of coherency and transparency and logic in those reports that do not exist in anything else that the ICC prosecutors under this administration have released. I would exchange half of the policy papers for that Christmas gift again, our preliminary examination report every November, December. But I don't think that's the way that they're going. And instead, they prefer these policy reports and then glossy magazines featuring various quotes that have already been published from Karim Khan over the year.
Yeah, instead of having the preliminary investigations report, the last one, I think, was 2020, right at the end of Bensouda's reign. I just read back the 2019 one to figure out where they were in Palestine. And now they give a very glossy year report, which gives some information, but not. But now we get to something that is a little more substantive in the interview, and that is where Deputy Prosecutor Khan said that this new approach that we've been talking about, that it really got results.
So we have seen an unprecedented increase in the number of arrest warrants that we applied for using this new process, this revisited process of doing our work. So the first thing is, I think that victims on the ground feel encouraged when they see the discernible results, when they hear about them. They know that there are arrest warrants coming out of a process, and that it is really evident that that's improved in the way that we're working.
So, Steph, was that the golden nugget? Was that the one that you really picked up on, that there's an increase in the numbers of arrest warrants applied for?
Yes, because she says there's an unprecedented number of an increase of the stuff they applied for. And of course, I tried to get some more information because we're not seeing an unprecedented number of arrest warrants coming out of the OTP at the moment. So that means there is a backlog. So that suggests that they've applied for a lot more than we're seeing, either because they're under seal or because the judges are taking a long time, or maybe that they rejected the arrest warrants. And she said something later when I asked about if she's worried about empty courtrooms. She also dropped a hint that there was a lot of activity in pretrial chambers and appeals chambers, which suggests to me that some of those requests that they made were perhaps not granted on the first try and they had to appeal them. But of course, they didn't want to give any further details. But I'm telling you that here now anyway. So it seems like there's a lot happening pretrial. Finally, I also put to her the criticism that there seems to be selectivity in resources and also activity on the ground, with the prosecutor kind of dashing off to Ukraine at a moment's notice a couple of times a year, and having been in the Middle East region only twice, once on the border with Egypt and Rafah, and once actually in Israel, but for a non-investigative visit, just a kind of getting to meet visit.
I know there is always going to be a level of agitation that, you know, not all children are being treated in the same way and at the same speed. That perception is, I think, real. I mean, in the sense that this is what people really believe. But the more that we discuss with them what we are doing as much as we can within the bounds of confidentiality, the more victims and survivors understand that we are moving towards a goal, but that in each situation, that speed will depend very much on things like access to a country, our ability to relate closely with countries in the region, as well as regional organizations, with the UN, which is always very helpful in all the work that we do, and with CSOs. So on the one hand, we believe in CSO outreach and transparency so that people understand we are doing something. We're not sitting on our hands. But on the other hand, we're so conscious of protecting confidentiality of the information that we have that we can't necessarily tell everyone everything. So with the accusations or suggestions that we are selective in the way that we put our resources, I would say that, for instance, looking at Sudan, Sudan was one of the earlier situations that was opened in the court, and we are regularly reporting to the Security Council. The prosecutor went to the Security Council, and he had a lot of questions about whether we were investigating current events, and he confirmed that indeed we are. We consider that that is within our jurisdiction. But then we need to have boots on the ground. So increased presence on the ground amongst victims and survivors have really helped to dissipate this feeling that some may have that we're not paying attention to Sudan because we're now concentrating on Ukraine and Palestine. So we are more on the ground. We have more field presence. We have rotational models. So in Bangladesh, for instance, we are almost constantly in Cox's Bazar. I think that helps. The closer you work with victims on the ground, I think the better it is in terms of giving people the confidence that we are doing something and that we're moving towards deadlines. But I have to say that every single situation, certainly in the stages of investigation, every single one has deadlines, internal deadlines for the teams. So they know they're working towards something. If the deadline is not achieved, then there's a short extension and we work towards that. So our working methods, really introduced by the prosecutor, who really wanted a faster result to display to the world that we are a relevant institution, I think it's working. And it's working in the results we get, because you can see the significant increase in arrest warrants, in the significant increase in CSO engagement, the increase in the policy work we do. All of that has ramped up.
So, Mark, what do you make of all of that, the significant increase in the arrest warrants being applied for? But the kind of language that she puts, to me at least, is very much managerial language. I'm also wondering, is she saying basically that the office of the prosecutor hasn't really been pushed very hard under previous prosecutors and now it's having to work well? Lots of odd things in there. What did you make of it?
Yeah, I mean, I think we've seen some criticism from this administration of the last one on repeated issues, including whether or not they staffed the Palestine investigation, etc. I read some tension here too, that maybe the previous prosecutor and the office under Fatou Bensouda didn't do enough. And look, now we're doing all of these things. I agree, Steph. When I read or heard an unprecedented increase in the number of arrest warrants, I was like, is that true? So I agree with your kind of spidey sense to think, well, if that is true, and they're openly saying it's an unprecedented increase, because even if it's an increase, I'm not convinced it's unprecedented, then I think you might be onto something with the sealed warrants. But I'm not sure. I was surprised to read this idea of the unprecedented increase in arrest warrants and for them so openly claiming that it's significant.
Yeah, well, I looked a bit about it and thought, like, what could make it unprecedented? How many arrest warrants have we had each year? And it's also not a lot. You know, we already had 2 arrest warrants for Ukraine this year. And I think I looked around a bit and came up, like, there was one year where there may be 5 arrest warrants for Uganda. They were a fair amount.
I agree. I think it basically just needs a small number for it to feel an unprecedented number. I mean, even a doubling of the numbers equals 10 probably sealed arrest warrants that we don't know about. And they aren't all necessarily, I imagine, for Ukraine and Palestine. I can also imagine a number of arrest warrants to do with Libya. I can imagine some arrest warrants to do with Sudan that are sealed.
I think Khan already said last year that he was filing 2 sealed arrest warrants for Libya. Maybe he's trying to get unsealed. We know they're those 2 sealed ones. That's what he told the UN Security Council. But what is happening with that, we don't know. I was looking at how long it takes to apply for an arrest warrant and to get it. And I saw that for Georgia, it took 2 months from application to delivering the arrest warrant. I think for the Ukraine arrest warrants, the most recent ones about attacking civilian infrastructure, that took about 4 or 5 months. So that's a very long period then compared to the dosing. There was a change, of course, in judges and in trial chambers. So maybe there's also some working there that's going slower than it usually is. It's really hard to say. We really don't have a lot of visibility on those kinds of workings. I don't think there is a time limit for when you apply for an arrest warrant and when the judge has to rule on it. I tried to look for that, but couldn't find it. So we don't really know how long things can stay in pretrial. And then also, what if they rejected it and there comes an appeals process?
Yeah, super, super interesting. And one way or the other, I mean, it's an interesting communication strategy that even as a close follower of the ICC, I wouldn't have thought we were in a time of unprecedented issuance of arrest warrants. So even if it is numerically true or quantitatively true that they've issued 4, 2 or more than any other year, let's say, it's suggestive of some massive amounts of activity. And maybe that's true. And I'm curious to find out if that's true. And if it is, I think that that's important, right? I'm not someone, I know I spoke briefly about this before, about the importance of enforcing arrest warrants, even if the ICC has very little influence over that. But I am someone who thinks that there is justice in the process of pursuing justice and that arrest warrants are important in and of themselves. So I'm going to go back to this question of speed. I mean, I think people deserve to be told things at face value. So we started this interview and this conversation around there's no two speeds between different types of contexts. And that was a response between there's no two speeds between Palestine and Ukraine. But here we have an acknowledgement that there must be two speeds because the deputy prosecutor literally saying speed will depend on things like access to the country. They have access to Ukraine, albeit not Russia, but they have access to Ukraine. They do not have access for investigation purposes to either Gaza, West Bank, or Israel. So that's an implicit admission that there are structural reasons to have different speeds, that it's not as easy to investigate when you don't have access to the crime scene, so you can't go as fast. I think it would just be helpful if they said that, if they said from the outset, yes, there are going to be different speeds because we're dealing with different situations. And Ukraine isn't like Palestine for us because in Palestine, we need to make sure that we have evidence and that's going to take us longer because we're not there when a hospital or a university is blown to smithereens. Whereas if a maternity ward is destroyed in parts of Ukraine, we can access that within a couple of weeks. We were in Bucha within a couple of weeks of that happening. So our forensic scientists are able to do work that they cannot do on, say, the mass graves that were just discovered in Gaza. And that makes sense, right? So again, I wish that there was just a little bit more transparency or coherency around some of this, because what I worry about, and I know that I'm a bit of a broken drum on this or whatever you want to call it, and I've always thought there's a way to communicate the ICC's work that is effective, that is clear, that doesn't divulge confidential materials, but things like the preliminary examination report, the yearly one, we're quite good at that. What I worry about is that when you get it wrong, you're doing two things. You are telling somebody there's no two speeds, so we're impartial and we treat every situation equally. And then just minutes later, you're actually saying whether or not we move quickly or not actually depends on these things. So you're telling people implicitly that there are two speeds. And I think it's from that kind of confusion or those two different kinds of messages that people end up being frustrated with the ICC over things that are not within its control, right? The story here is we would move faster if Israel would let us into Israel and Gaza. That's the story, not we work equally as fast across all situations, but actually we don't because we don't have access to Gaza. The story is let us into Gaza so that the speed can be similar to what we've done in Ukraine. And I think that's the kind of persuasive messaging that is sometimes sorely missed by prosecutors who try instead to tell the world how great the ICC is. And then also when moments of honesty end up telling them that they're structurally bound to politics or whatever it is, so they can't do all of these things and leave a confused message that breeds further confusion, but then also a degree of angst. And then eventually that angst translates into anger. What's so frustrating in some ways about this, it's not in my mind particularly difficult to nail that message and to say something really important to people who are rightfully, and the deputy prosecutor notes it, I think really well, that they're rightfully and acceptably impatient about inaction for the atrocities that are happening in their communities and in their countries.
You said before about the enforcement of arrest warrants. So I also put to the deputy prosecutor the critique that there is kind of not enough people in prison in the pipeline, essentially, for going to court, and that the judges might be twiddling their thumbs in a year or two, and that there will be empty courtrooms.
I've heard that concern expressed by states, by national authorities. So I know that that is something that's expressed quite frequently. The first is on fugitive tracking. The prosecutor is looking at increasing the kind of attention we give to fugitive tracking. But we have to remember that ultimately arrest is the registry's baby. as it were. And so it is the registry that leads on fugitive tracking and arrest and surrender and so on. But I think it is a collaborative process, and we can at least help by trying to find out where fugitives are. And in that sense, the prosecutor has put more attention and resources into a dedicated fugitive tracking unit with a sort of determination that we do everything we can to try and ensure that there are more boots on the ground in the courtrooms.
Okay, well, I'm actually quite enthused by that response. Do you remember, Steph, we did an episode on how the Rwanda Tribunal and the Yugoslav Tribunal, now called the MICT, had really ramped up and changed how they did their fugitive tracking towards the end of the lives of those tribunals. I think it's really important that these international courts work with states to try and track down people and clear the decks.
Indeed, I understand that they want to put the fugitive tracking up there. I wonder in the ICC how useful it is, because some of the big cases, you know, the really big fish that you want to have, it's no secret where Omar al-Bashir, the former president of Sudan, is. Neither is it hard to figure out where Vladimir Putin is or his commissioner for child rights. Yeah, so is a fugitive tracking unit the thing that's going to deliver the big fish to the ICC, or are we then focusing again on medium level people? So I wonder how that's going to play out. But I think it's at least, you need to at least try. I was surprised that there wasn't something like that, because it's also a very good pressure mechanism, which we saw in the Yugoslav tribunals and in the Rwanda cases, where you can go to local authorities, especially when these people are not in their own country anymore. Post-conflict, you can say this person is in your territory and you are an ICC member and here's what we found and please go arrest him. That's also a way of kind of naming and shaming local authorities or ICC members who might not otherwise move to arrest these people. So I see the importance in that, but I wonder for the ICC if it gets the really big trials.
I appreciate your comments, both of your comments on that, because I think I am somewhat enthusiastic about this too. It seems new and interesting, this idea of fugitive tracking by the ICC. I agree that for the big fish, say the presidents, etc., you don't really need to do that much fugitive tracking. They're going to publicly travel to places. Also, if you're going to issue an arrest warrant for them and then seek to arrest them, I know that there's an accepted protocol where there is warning to that state. When it issued an arrest warrant against Omar al-Bashir, there was a conversation about whether that warrant should be sealed so that if he did travel, they could unseal it and try and, you know, get that warrant enforced. And the decision within the office of the prosecutor was no, you cannot literally have regime change over an arrest warrant that becomes unsealed because you track this person to a state that has an obligation to enforce it. So I think with those big fish, it's not as important. But with, say, just under that, I think it can be important. I really like your point, Steph, that this could be helpful in putting pressure on states to do more around prohibiting these people from entering their territory. I think the ICC could at times benefit from being a little bit more strategic and opportunistic in when and how it issues arrest warrants. So if it's building cases against someone who's committing atrocities in Darfur or parts of Sudan, and they know that that person is also engaged in transnational organized crime, right? Which is very common in Sudan because of the use of gold and whatnot. Or if they're tracking LRA members, let's say Joseph Kony, who they believe is still alive, who knows, is also engaged in elephant ivory related trafficking. There's a possibility that someone involved in those atrocities or the actual authors of those atrocities need to have assets outside of the country. Because if you have a lot of assets in Sudan, I promise you, you're not going to keep them in Sudan. What are you going to do? Well, a lot of these people build hotels or buy hotels in places like Nairobi. And then when they're tired of being in Khartoum, which is under attack, they can't go to other places, but they can go to their own hotels. And they can go to the banks where they've stashed their millions or billions, right? And so I think fugitive tracking should be seen not just as something that happens once you issue an arrest warrant, where's this person going, but how do you track the movement of potential perpetrators for whom you may issue arrest warrants, and think about, again, strategically taking the opportunity of potentially issuing those arrest warrants when they're moving to places that do, in fact, have obligations to the ICC. That becomes a bit tricky. But I think in terms of like domestic or national enforcement of those arrest warrants in, say, a country like Kenya or Uganda or whatever. But I think it's that type of thinking that tracks the movements of the people that you're looking at issuing arrest warrants for that could be quite useful, whether or not you have a sealed warrant or you don't yet have a warrant. And thinking again, how do you give the ICC the best chance to have a warrant issued and enforced within the quickest amount of time? And I don't think you can do that unless you're thinking a little bit about these types of movements of perpetrators from one place to another, and then identifying the most likely state or law enforcement agency that would actually then enforce that warrant. So I think it's a good idea. It remains to be seen. My guess, coming back full circle, we'll see a policy paper on this at some point, whether or not it works or doesn't work. Who knows?
Out of the mouths of babes there, I think there is a policy paper coming up on cooperation. So I'm sure fugitives will be included.
Yeah, I wanted to say that I don't remember if it's this interview or that I read it in something else or in the year report or looked at the budget for the OTP for this year. But I know that they are opening up a position or trying to get more people to go on the forensic finance situation, tracking people. So maybe that is tied in. I also wanted to add that there is also, of course, as we talked about before, not so much the OTP can control and when the arrest warrants come out. There's also the period of when the judges have looked at it. And what we saw with Putin arrest warrant is that it's the judges that control that coming out. If the OTP is believed, or what they told us is that they didn't know exactly when that was going to come out. They know they applied for that, but they couldn't kind of orchestrate the date of when that was going to come out. Because, you know, we in The Hague, we always complain about the Friday night syndrome or the Thursday night syndrome of the OTP of the ICC, where at 6 or 7 p.m. on a Thursday or a Friday, all of a sudden you have these huge announcements. And for those who don't really work in the media, I can tell you anything after 5 p.m. on a Friday is a complete media black hole, because most news organizations plan their weekends pretty full and far ahead. So unless you have groundbreaking front page news, that's going to fall into a hole. But it's really, really every court here does that. They kind of tend to clear the decks on a Friday and then send out stories. But when we complained about it, we were told very much so that it wasn't the prosecutors that picked the time for announcing these arrest warrants. And that was from the court. So something to also think about.
Yeah, it's a good point. I don't really buy it that they're entirely unable to figure out how to use these warrants. Maybe they can't determine when the sealed warrant is issued. I think they can find ways and strategic ways to identify when to inform people of those warrants. There is, again, another elephant in the room, and it would be a great episode that I think you guys would be so good at, which is espionage and intelligence at the ICC. On the one hand, we're talking about this idea that if Karim Khan gets a sealed warrant, that he can be like, aha, here you go. We have an arrest warrant for you, immediately enforced, because I've been so smart and strategically planning when it's unsealed, right? It may very well be that depending on the perpetrator, they already know that that exists, because I don't think you should see the ICC as somehow immune to, well, it's not immune to intelligence operations. We saw last week, right, that the Netanyahu government is concerned about ICC warrants coming down by the ICC. I don't think they would be as worried as they were unless they had, and I don't know if the intelligence is good, but unless they had intelligence from within the court that there could be something forthcoming that may be dealing with some of their alleged war crimes and crimes against humanity. And so I think very often people will be tipped off before that happens. Whether that's a good thing or a bad thing is a question again for a different episode and an interesting one. But that may also play into this idea around fugitives is, you know, you would need state cooperation, which means that states would then know about these fugitives as well. States may not have the same interest as the ICC in having these people arrested and having arrest warrants enforced. So I think it gets a little bit complicated. But if it's the start of doing something more around tracking and strategic thinking about, or just utilizing cognitive and intellectual and quantitative tools to reduce the distance between arrest warrants being issued and being enforced. I think that's good. And so too, and I know we're not talking about this, but this step, what you mentioned about looking at the money, looking after the money, was actually something that Ocampo wanted to do initially in 2004, 2005, and it kind of got pushed to the side. I personally think that that would be a game changer. If you could do that well, if you could track the money of perpetrators, you would crack the fugitive tracking bit, because I'm pretty sure they're moving for money. They're not moving for most other reasons. Maybe some politicians are, but still, they're always moving for money. And I think you would get a much richer sense, which we miss sometimes, which is the question of how is it possible for these crimes to happen in the first place? And of course, they need money, they need funding. They are intimately linked to organized crimes, transnational organized crimes, and other forms of criminality that are ultimately, at the end of the day, very lucrative to the perpetrators who are involved. And I think having a much richer sense of exactly what that looks like can help potentially build aiding and abetting cases, complicity cases, sure, but can also shift the ICC from a court that only understands what to do once a crime happens to a court that also understands how it is that these atrocities happen at all.
That sounds like a great idea for the future. Let's hope that that actually happens. Thank you so much, Mark, for taking the time to talk us through this interview and what is going on with the ICC or not, and what all we can see from the murky trapezoid windows that we like to peer into.
Thank you. Thank you both.
So just before we wrap up, I'd like to do a congratulations to one of our supporters.
Yes, he's been with us from the beginning and he always listens to every episode and we get helpful notes. It's wonderful.
And even last weekend, just as he was getting married, he sent a message to say that he had noted that the episode had dropped for the week.
So we just want to say
congratulations to my brother, John Anderson, and to Sarah Izzard.
From the whole Asymmetrical Haircuts team, yay! Go John and Sarah. It looked wonderful. Janet sent us pictures. It looked lovely. I know she read a poem in her lovely Mother of the Bride pink suit, so I hope you enjoyed it. She sent us the poem and the whole Asymmetrical Haircuts group chat was kind of blinking away a little tear at the beautiful poem you picked out. So wonderful. Congratulations.
And finally, on the podcast, we always try to help out with a quick reminder of how you can support us the same way that Mark has given us just there so much verbal support. You can also give us some support on Patreon.
And a shout out to those who have subscribed there and now get also our newsletter. And for those who pay for a coffee for us each month, much appreciated, or via the tip jar. And they also get the War Criminals Book Club extra podcast we make there if you support Patreon. So thank you so much for your support. It keeps us in good spirits and also our interns with some extra money.
So thank you very much to Dan Keevy
and Mel Abramov
and Isis
and Steve Crawshaw
and Swancha. Thank you very much. You're a top tier supporter, so thank you also for the cake.
And we have Tappa and Seal. Yes, this person also follows me on Twitter, so I'm quite curious. But thank you, Tappan Seal, and love the username.
And Bavarium335.
And there is Ron.
And also thank you to Angie Manivanan, and also thank you, Angie, for the cake.
Yes, and Kate, thank you, who also got subscribed on Patreon.
So remember again, you too can subscribe. If you just want to get the newsletter, you can just join Patreon for free and we'll send you the newsletter. But that way you also never miss a podcast. You also find out what we're reading. But if you want to, you can also pay something at Patreon and give us a leg up that way.
Thank you so much for all the support, whether via Patreon, also on Twitter, and shout outs that we see. It's lovely. We love doing this job, but the fact that people actually want to listen and enjoy it makes it all the more better. So thank you so much.
This was Asymmetrical Haircuts, your international justice podcast, created and presented by Janet Anderson and Stephanie van den Berg. Music is by audionautics.com. And you can find show notes and everything about the podcast on asymmetricalhaircuts.com. This show is available on every major podcast service, so please subscribe, give us a rating, and spread the word.